So
And
you
but
left
I, you know, after
BCG to do this. You left BCG and went into this full time.
they were very kind to, you know, say, okay, hey, take a leave of absence and, you know, take 6 months, and, you know, if you want to come back, we'll be happy to have you back. And I mean, I decided at that point in time that, you know, I wanted to do something a little bit faster paced, which was ironic because what I chose to do after that was to go to Himachal and spend a year, you know, in the village farming, which is definitely not faster paced. But I think the intent there was, you know, really, how do you, I had this, you know, it had really impacted me very deeply growing up. And, you know, my parents were like, you know, hey, this, you know, farming is not going to be a place to make a living, right? At least at the scale that, you know, they were farming, it was definitely not. You know, I remember my first salary out of college, right? I mean, I made more money that year than people that, you know, my parents had probably made in the, you know, the last 5 years. And that struck me as, you know, that's just not right, right? I mean,
Hey Ashish, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. Really looking forward to the chat.
Thank you, Averil and Mazin, for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to, you know, share a little bit about myself on those days.
Yeah, so maybe we can start with before college and college. Any seeds that were planted in your mind of entrepreneurship, if they were, if not, any key decisions you made,
Lost you a little bit.
any key decisions that brought you to this path as well during, you know, before college, and going forward.
So I think, you know, let me maybe start at the very beginning, right? And I think, looking back, you know, you can probably draw a lot of straight lines and say, you know, this informed that and all that. But I definitely didn't sort of play out in that way in my mind, at least. I was born in Shimla. My parents are apple farmers in, you know, in upper Himachal. In fact, you know, the place where the first commercial apple tree was planted in India, you know, close to about 100 years ago, is about, you know, 500 meters from where my mother grew up, right? So heart of the apple growing belt. Spent the first year and a half in village school. You know, my mother likes to tell how I rebelled and effectively, you know, tried to drop out of, you know, nursery class in village because I wanted to, you know, do something different. And thankfully, you know, my parents said, you know, okay, let's move to the city. You know, it may be a good place to provide, you know, at least opportunities to actually have a different life, you know, other than farming. And so I grew up in Chandigarh. You know, spent till, you know, the age of 18 in Chandigarh. You know, went to IIT Delhi. You've talked about the typical path. Land up in IIT Delhi. Interesting, you know, path to IIT Delhi as well. I think, you know, Chandigarh was very interesting in that sense that, you know, you didn't really need to have a lot of money to actually live an interesting life, right? I think there was a lot of opportunities, small city, you know. So I learned horse riding. I did a whole bunch of martial arts. And, you know, parents didn't have a lot of money, but, you know, it afforded a small city with a lot of, you know, a lot of infrastructure for, you know, leading a pretty interesting life in that sense, right? And I think, learned French when I was, you know, 14. You know, spent about 2 years learning French, and that was actually a very pivotal moment in my life. I mean, I think, you know, when I was 16, during the 1998 World Cup in France, you know, France organized this World Cup, you know, related competition all across the world, where it was a French-speaking competition where you could participate. And I was one of the, you know, five winners from India. It was a global competition. First time I ever saw, you know, went anywhere outside this country was to go and see the World Cup. You know, the French government organized this 15-day trip. Went and saw a bunch of matches. Met people from, you know, 150 countries around the world. I mean, mind-blowing experience. Changed the entire trajectory of my life. And I think that when I came back, you know, I was like, okay, I want to do something, you know, different with my life. I didn't really have a big, you know, big clue about what that was. But I said, you know, I want to do something that exposes me a little bit to the world, because this has been a pretty transformational experience. I mean, it's 15 days, but when you're 16 years old, I mean, you know, your life, my horizons completely opened up. And I came back and I was in this little bit of a haze for the next 2, 3 months, saying, you know, what do I do? But I looked around and all my friends were, you know, studying for, you know, IIT. And I said, okay, you know, this seems like what smart people do. And I'd done okay in school, so I decided to do that. That year was really interesting. I mean, you know, you know, everybody was, I think the year 2000, you know, I remember, you know, big millennium, you know, change in sort of the world. Everybody was talking about how Y2K will, you know, destroy the world. And I was sitting there preparing, you know, for the JEE entrance on 2nd of January, right? But yeah, that changed my life here. I mean, I think ended up at IIT Delhi. A lot of people from, you know, who I grew up with in Chandigarh ended up there at the same time. So it was, you know, a great new experience, but also, you know, around a lot of people that I'd grown up with. And then from there, you know, spent 5 years at IIT. I'm happy to, you know, I don't know how you guys want to do this. You know, do you want me to just continue going all the way through?
Yeah, I
think IIT was again, you know, very, very, again, you know, interesting point. I remember that year, you know, I landed up, and in the first year of college, you know, I got every single grade that there was possible to get, like from an A to an E, and E is a failing grade, right? So I was like, you know, full spectrum. You know, when I got the E, it shakes your confidence, right? I mean, you're like, okay, you've done well throughout life, and suddenly you're here, and you know, suddenly you're like, oh crap, you know, you're around a lot of very smart people, and you have to work hard. Yeah. And that was a big wake up call, I think, for me. And you know, next, I was in the 5-year dual degree at IIT Delhi, studying biochemical engineering, and so you know, really decided, okay, here's, you know, I really need to sort of demonstrate to myself and to other people that, you know, I can do something substantial, and that was that, you know, started off, I guess, a very interesting, you know, remaining 4 years at IIT. Played a lot of sports, played literally everything, debated, quizzed, you know, did dramatics. I think the beauty of, you know, IIT Delhi at that time was, and one of the reasons why I chose to go to IIT Delhi over other places, other limited choices that I had during counseling, was, you know, this was a place where I felt like I would also be able to, you know, do a lot of other co-curricular activities. And so I think that played out really well, and I had a blast, made a lot of great friends, I think learned just the power of really working really hard, and, you know, not really banking on being smart yet. I mean, I think, you know, that was a good wake-up call early on in life. Was very, very interested at one point in time, I think, in you know, a master's and a PhD in biochemical engineering. I was doing a lot of work in wastewater treatment, and I felt like, you know, growing up, I spent every summer when I was growing up on the farm in Himachal, you know, so deep exposure to, you know, food and agriculture, rural life. You know, 2.5-3 months a year was spent in the village. And, you know, when you're there, you kind of have to, you know, participate in the whole process of, you know, harvesting, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, grew up around that, saw a lot of the challenges that people in rural areas face, saw a lot of the challenges around, you know, no young person wanted to be a farmer. I mean, that's unfortunately true even today, right? I mean, most people there's a romantic notion that, you know, maybe people like us have, oh, you know, I'll go, you know, get a plot of land and work on it. But, you know, if you have to, you know, live off that that living, it's a hard life. And I think that was one big lesson that I took away from that, which was, you know, my parents were very very clear early on that, you know, you have to have a plan that does not necessarily involve farming, because it's going to be a tough life. And I think for me, that really impacted me, because I think a lot of my adult life has really been about, you know, is there a way to change that, right? Is there a way to make farming a meaningful, viable, financially viable option that people have in rural India? Because there's 600 million of our countrymen, you know, and women working in that, and, you know, that's a large number of people. At the end of the day. And, you know, it's a pretty, you know, it's only about 15-18% of GDP, but it is, you know, nearly half the you know, the population of our country. Right. And I think as a country we're going to, you know, truly realize this demographic dividend that we keep talking about, I think we're going to have to find meaningful ways to actually, you know, provide large scale employment for people who are currently involved in farming. And I think, for me, that has been something that I have really thought a lot about for pretty much my entire adult life. And I think, you know, what Jumbotail today is a manifestation of some of that thinking along the way. And we'll get to that maybe later on in this conversation. Yeah. But, you know, I think I realized in college that while I loved, you know, the academic parts of wastewater treatment, water, and again, those were also, you know, those interests were also related to, you know, water plays a very important life in agriculture. It plays a very important role in urban, you know, making urban settlements good places to live in. And so I almost, you know, I spent a summer, you know, running around Denmark, basically going from one wastewater treatment plant to another, collecting samples of sewage to basically analyze, right? And it probably wasn't the most, it wasn't the coolest, way of spending a summer. But, I was in Europe. I was doing interesting things. And it was my way to get to, seeing a little bit more of the world. And I loved it. And I came back very, convinced that I would apply for a PhD and really do, spend my life, working in wastewater treatment and water. And that interest has not really gone away. I mean, I continue to sort of, look for ways to do that in an entrepreneurial way. And someday, maybe after Jumbotail, there's another, startup in me. My wife's going to kill me when she hears this. maybe there's another one in me after this, right? And that definitely will be, related to that. But I think one realization after working, two summers in labs was I felt like the solutions to many of these things lay in the business world. And, right. I had no business context. I mean, I didn't know anything about business. Everybody in the family was pretty much, almost everybody was farming. And I said, okay, I need to go to a place where I can, learn, how businesses are built and maybe get a, fast track education in that.
Okay.
So got lucky in terms of, when I, in my final year, BCG was, decided that they wanted to hire people out of undergraduate institutions in India.
Yeah.
As one of five people that they hired in India in 2005. So went straight from IIT Delhi to, BCG, spent about 4 years at BCG, about 2.5 years in India,
okay.
Year and a half in Chicago.
Nice.
Then went to business school, came back to BCG, spent a total of about 6 years at BCG, both in India and the US. Again, right, as Avirul was saying, very, very, many people, including some people on your podcast, I was telling you earlier, right? I mean, I heard Raghu's podcast. Raghu's a senior mind from IIT Delhi, and okay. I have a lot of respect for him. And, so this consulting and going, then trying to do something entrepreneurial sounds very typical. But I did a lot of very different things in my, in my mind, right? I decided very early on that, being partner and living a sort of a life of a consultant long term was probably not what I wanted.
Okay.
And therefore, I said, okay, let me choose to work on, projects or cases that the single criteria I sort of said, I'll employ was, is this going to be an interesting story someday, right? And if it's going to be an interesting story someday, I want to do it. And as a result of that, I ended up doing this, I ended up doing a very eclectic mix of things, right? I worked on what eventually, became the blueprint or at least an input into the blueprint for the World Test Cricket Championship. I worked on, in a tuna processing plant in Mauritius. Was one of the few people involved in actually starting, BCG India's social impact practice, where we worked extensively with government. In fact, nearly 3 years out of my 6 years at BCG were spent working on the public distribution system. So, which is, the system, Indian government system of, where they hand out ration cards to about 800 million people in the country, and Food Corporation of India procures, wheat, rice from farmers and then transports it over thousands of kilometers. There's about 800 million people. Government spends about $20 billion every year on it. And, in 2005, the government had come out with a study which said that, 50-55% of the food actually doesn't find its way to the right beneficiaries. And I said, this is, there happened to be a project BCG used to do a lot of work with, the World Food Program. And there happened to be a project that they were contemplating doing. And I basically, chased after this partner in Rome for, I think, 3 months before, he said, okay, let's find a way to be on this. And what it was supposed to be a 3 month project turned into a year and a half of, running around all over rural India. I have these photos of me wearing a gamcha, sitting in a truck in rural MP, really sitting in these vehicles and seeing, where this material is going, how it's going to be handed out, what are the challenges, how are the, where does the leakage happen? And it gave me a deep appreciation and a fascination for, all things supply chain, all things food, all things in many ways, retail as well, right? And I think, again, if I look back now, a lot of those things are dots that can connect towards, sort of what I'm doing at Jumbotail. But, back then it was more about, this is an incredible way of me learning about how this country operates, large percentages of our, population, our food insecure. Right.
And it was linked back to your passion about helping.
And again, yeah, I mean, I like to say food's in my blood, but it also became something that became an intellectual, you know, and a sort of a professional passion of mine. And, you know, it sort of captures a lot of the things that I like, right? I mean, large scale technology, being at the cutting edge, but not being afraid to get your hands dirty, right? I mean, getting working on operations, working at large scale, working, you know, in chaotic environments which don't necessarily welcome technology. And that's been another thread, I think, in life that I have gravitated towards, which is, you know, large problems which involve very, very large numbers of people, lots of different stakeholders, and where, you know, where technology can play a role.
I think that's where that, like, jump from consulting to having that kind of exposure, perhaps there's some parallels there. But walk us through that transition. You know, you spent a while at BCG, but you knew that this wasn't what you wanted to do long term. How did you make that switch, take the plunge?
Very, very serendipitous path, yeah. I mean, I don't think that it was ever, I've never really operated in that manner. I think, you know, even if I look at sort of, I spent 6 months right after BCG working on Nandan Nilekani's election campaign for the Lok Sabha in 2014. And that again came out from one conversation where, you know, a lot of the work that I was doing with BCG, and I mean, it was incredible that they let me do this for such a long time, because it didn't necessarily make them money, but, you know, I loved the opportunities that it gave me. But I'd gotten to know Nandan a little bit better, because we were using, my first instance working with the public distribution system was pre-Aadhaar, and I realized, you know, how big these problems were around identity, et cetera, and we enrolled 1 million people actually in a multimodal biometric program in Odisha in 2006 and 2007. And I just, you know, hats off to what our country's been able to do with Aadhaar, where, you know, looking back, I mean, it's a miracle that this happened, right? And I'd gotten to know Nandan a little bit during that time, because this next version of me working on the public distribution system and direct benefits transfer was in, you know, implementing Aadhaar in that context. And so when I heard, you know, he was running for election, I said, okay, I got to find a way to, you know, be part of that. And, you know, I spoke to, you know, some people on his campaign. They were very gracious enough to say, hey, come in and, you know, you're welcome to actually participate. And so, again, transformational period of about, you know, 4, 5 months, 6 months working on the campaign gave me a really deep appreciation for how democracy in this country works. And I walked away with, you know, just a lot of learning around how large groups of people think, how technology can really play a very important role.
To do this, we left BCG and went into this full time.
They were very kind to, you know, say, okay, hey, take a leave of absence and, you know, take 6 months. And, you know, if you want to come back, we'll be happy to have you back. And I mean, it's the only company that I, you know, outside of Jumbotail that I've ever worked at. And I owe a ton of gratitude to, you know, they let me do a lot of things that I think today people would find, you know, how did you manage to do that?
Like you said,
people were very, 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 very encouraging and nice. I mean, they just said, you know, come back in 6 months if you want. But I decided at that point in time that, you know, I wanted to do something a little bit faster paced, which was ironic, because what I chose to do after that was to go to Himachal and spend a year, in the village farming, which is definitely not faster paced. But I think the intent there was, you know, really, how do you... I'd had this, you know, it had really impacted me very deeply growing up. And, you know, my parents were like, you know, hey, this, you know, farming is not going to be a place to make a living, right? At least at the scale that, you know, they were farming, it was definitely not, you know, I remember my first salary out of college, right? I mean, I made more money that year than people that, you know, my parents had probably made in the, you know, the last 5 years. And that struck me as, you know, that's just not right, right? I mean, there has to be a better way of doing that. And so I spent a year in Himachal, with the intent of saying, okay, let's take everything that, you know, people say will help farmers, you know, make more money. It's obviously, you know, something the government of India has always been talking about for a long period of time. Yeah. How do you get farmers to increase incomes, etc.? And so I tried out a variety of different things. I said, you know, let me try like an MVP type of approach to say, okay, what will work? And so I experimented with, you know, what it would take to set up a chain of, you know, cold storage facilities. So if you look at, you know, my area in Himachal, it's, you know, apple, cherries, plums, you know, pears, apricots, temperate fruit that, you know, need, you know, comes once a year, and then you sort of, you know, you make whatever money.
So it's the whole thinking about the whole distribution from getting it from there to the stores. And, yeah.
I mean, a lot of the work we've, you know, that's been done in the country, you know, if you look back at the Green Revolution, if you look at, you know, things that people have done, it largely has been focused around, you know, how do you increase productivity? How do you make, you know, the same plot of land, you know, more productive?
Yeah, yeah.
And my original thought process was around that as well, right? I mean, can you bring in, you know, imported varieties? Can you find ways where, you know, especially with climate change, can you make, you know, agriculture more resilient? And again, I truly believe those are important problems that are only going to become more and more pivotal. But I think in my you know process of sort of doing these MVPs in you know across 2014, 2015, I came to the realization that, you know, be it, let's say, you know, cold storage or be it, you know, food processing, make a lot of jams, jellies, squashes, things like that, or even direct to consumer selling, right? There's a lot of intermediaries between, you know, farmers and you know, end consumers. And so the price we pay, not a lot of it actually finds its way back, right? And so the idea was, you know, how do you sort of solve for any of those problems? And that's when, you know, I started, again, happenstance. I'm a big believer in, you know, serendipity. I'd gone to Stanford for my MBA, and one of my, you know, classmates there, Karthik, who is now my co-founder at Jumbotail, you know, we just happened to sort of meet there, hadn't met him for a while. And I was telling him, you know, here's what I'm doing.
At Dharamshala, like while you were working?
At the wedding. No, this was a wedding in Delhi. You know, I think this is December 2014. I said, you know, I've been living this whole mountain man life for a while. Let me go and see what, you know, civilization looks like a little bit. So I went down to Delhi, and, you know, one of our classmates was getting married. And you know, it's a small class at Stanford. I mean, you know, we were about 380 people in total, probably 10 or 12 people from India. So, you know, we knew each other well. Right. So I ended up meeting Karthik there and telling him, you know, here's what I'm doing. And he had an interesting journey. You know, he was a soldier. You know, he went from, you know, Siachen to, you know, he likes to tell, you know, a story from Kashmir Valley to Silicon Valley. He ended up at eBay and then Flipkart. And so we got talking about, you know, the role of e-commerce.
Yeah.
And it turned out that he'd tried something like this with coconut farmers in Madurai in 2008. So we got talking, you know, one thing sort of, you know, that conversation sparked a bunch of other conversations. And I think the fundamental realization was that if you really wanted to do something at scale to solve, you know, problems for not only farmers, but, you know, everybody else in the ecosystem, you know, starting on the supply side, working with farmers was probably not the right idea. Or at least, you know, not an idea that had a meaningful chance, at least in our mind, of impacting hundreds of millions of people. I mean, you know, get probably the fastest way of getting to tens of thousands of people, even hundreds of thousands of people. But if the scale of ambition in terms of, you know, creating impact was hundreds of millions of people, and today, you know, that scale is now a billion plus people in our minds, then, you know, our view was that the only way to do that is going to be if you start by, you know, really aggregating demand at scale. And that led us to, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about how India's food and grocery ecosystem is structured. And that, in a nutshell, sort of led us to what we've been doing at, you know, Jumbotail for the last 7.5 years.
So walk us through how the, I mean, you spoke about a couple of problems, right? One is the logistics and actually getting goods from one end to the other. The other problem, that's a pretty big problem, is waste. And when you talk about fresh produce, only a fraction of it actually gets used. Any more problem spaces that I'm missing? And how did you guys kind of zero in on what you're going to focus on?
Where do I get started as far as problems are concerned, right? I mean, I think this is a place where every single problem you could think of exists. And I think that, and therefore it was important to sort of, you know, not really, I mean, it's important to understand the problems the current ecosystem, you know, had. Okay. But at the same time, also try and, you know, reimagine this with a, you know, a complete blank slate, right? To say, okay. if I didn't necessarily have all of this, and let's say, you know, you're an alien and you land on this planet and you say, okay, I see and I observe a certain number of things, and you have this, no, you know, there's no sort of, you know,
beginner's mindset,
investment in, you know, there's no biases that you're operating with.
Yeah.
How would
you
build something? And how would you build something? I'm a big sports fan, and I watch a lot of sports. And, you know, when I was in the US, you know, people used to have this analogy, or they used to talk about, you know, Wayne Gretzky, who was one of the, you know, the greats in ice hockey. And they used to say, you know, Wayne Gretzky was great because he skated not where the puck was, the, you know, the little ice hockey puck. He skated where the puck was going to be. And so I think the thing, you know, and that was his talent. And if you look at pretty much any sport, right, be it football where you talk about Messi, or, you know, even cricket where you talk about the great batsman, it's all about, you know, knowing where the ball is going to be, not necessarily being where the ball is currently. And so in our mind, we said, you know, here's a few, you know, fundamental facts that we believe in. And then, you know, if those facts are going to play out, then, you know, what would you build not in in anticipation of those facts playing out? So one was, you know, as a country, India is going to get richer, right? People are going to be time poorer, but will have money, will have disposable income.
And it's a very young country. Context, this is what time frame? This is like...
This is 2015, early 2015. Okay. Right? So when once we started sort of saying, okay, we want to do something. We want to do something in the food and grocery space. We want to do something that, you know, impacts perhaps hundreds of millions of people, or if, you know, if we get lucky, a billion people.
Yeah.
And therefore, what are the problems that we want to solve for in the food and grocery ecosystem, right? Mm-hmm. All the way from consumer fork, all the way back to, you know, farm or factory, depending on, you know, what product you're talking about. Let's take a view of that sector. And then, you know, it doesn't really matter where you start, but you have to have a point of view on around, you know, what that thing is going to look like.
Over where it's going to go, right? So growth, exactly. India growing was one.
So India growing was one. Consumption growing was another one. We're a very young country. You know, that means people, you know, unlike our parents' generation, and I'm, you know, sort of lumping you in my generation, even though that might not be true. But, you know, unlike our parents' generation, where, you know, limited choices. I think people today, young people today, really want to express themselves and their own identities through the, you know, things that they consume, right? I mean, it's not just about, you know, who you say you are. You know, what you consume is also indicative of who you are. And so, I think we're as a country, I mean, we're a very brand-starved country. And I think the hypothesis was, with this, you know, increasing urbanization, increasing prosperity, increasing, you know, requirement for brands. And then on the other side, you know, I think it becoming a lot easier to manufacture, it becoming a lot easier to actually reach people. You don't have to do large TV ads anymore. You wouldn't have to do when we thought about this in 2015. And again, I think the impending just, you know, wave of the internet, right? I mean, I think we were, you know, it was still 2G, 3G at that point in time, but we said, I mean, it's only a matter of time. Yeah. And what does that really afford you in terms of solutions in this ecosystem? And again, starting on the demand side. And I think some things we said, okay, these are punts that we're going to take. You know, we don't know for sure whether they will happen. We felt confident, but, you know, it was definitely not, you know, when we were starting in 2015, you know, nobody was really placing a bet on, you know, Kiranas being the linchpins of, you know, food and grocery for the foreseeable future, right? This is the time when a lot of money was flowing into B2C internet. A lot of people were raising, you know, very large sums of capital to, you know, to build B2C companies in this space. And everybody was pronouncing, you know, the impending decline or doom or death of the Kirana ecosystem. Hasn't played out that way. And I guess we got lucky in that sense that, you know, the bet that we took around that. And it was not really just like a, you know, it wasn't a mindless.
It wasn't a random thing, right? It was like,
it wasn't a random
bet going into it. And you knew that this D2C thing was sort of, it was buzz. I think it was high.
I wouldn't settle down. I wouldn't call it a buzz, Ramazan. I think in my mind, you know, we make one of the biggest mistakes we make as a, you know, when we look at our country is it's not a monolithic entity, right? I mean, there's a lot of Indias. And so the good news when you're building anything in this country is that, you know, there will be a market and there will be a very large market. I mean, even, you know, B2C internet today and, you know, we'll find a market. I mean, you'll build very large companies, you'll create a lot of value. Mm-hmm. Will you create that necessarily for the largest number of people in this country? Perhaps not. But there will definitely be, you know, there's a lot of smart people, you know, trying to find solutions. And there will be a cohort of people that, you know, for whom those solutions will be valuable. And that's the beauty of our country today, right? Which is that you don't have to pick one path and solve for only that. I mean, yes, if you choose to pick a path, you must pick one path. But there's a lot of ways in which a lot of problems need to be solved. A lot of problems can be solved. And so I wouldn't necessarily pronounce that as a fad. I mean, I think there's a lot of value being created. But at least our mindset was what path will give us, you know, a potential path to, you know, impacting a billion people. And to us, that was a path in food and grocery. That was a path in, you know, really centering around the Kirana store and the Kirana entrepreneur. Because our belief was that, you know, Kiranas will continue to remain a very important part. They will have to evolve, obviously, both in terms of, you know, how they deal with consumers, how they serve their markets, but also how they you know, interact with manufacturers. But we felt that was what we wanted to build. And, you know, one hypothesis around, you know, aggregating demand and then working our way backwards up towards, you know, sources of production was something that, you know, we very early on identified. You know, I think there was a whiteboarding discussion that we had with, you know, Samir Brijvarma at Nexus, who was, you know, I don't know how he found, you know, that we were doing something. We didn't even have a company at that point in time. And, again, like, we got very lucky, right? I mean, we had a seed check before we had a company. I don't trivialize that advantage. And, you know, I think, but we drew out this, I remember Karthik, my co-founder, drew up this large, you know, map of this ecosystem and, you know, our vision of what would happen over a 10, 15, 20 year period. we're still, you know, for the most part, executing along that that plan. And you know, some days we look back and say, okay, you know, on some elements it's we're further along, and some elements I think we're still waiting for the world to change. But I think it's pretty heartening to, you know, to be able to have this vision of what you wanted to build, and for large parts of it to, you know, slowly be coming true. It's a lot of work. It's been a lot of fun. It's not been always, you know, smooth sailing. But you know, looking back, I mean, I wouldn't have done it any other way.
It's incredible. I mean, it brings me back to the analogy that you had of anticipating where the ball is going to go and making sure that you're there. And walk us through maybe the next steps, right? So you had this vision, mm-hmm. you got your seat check. How did you build out your MVP, get a team together? How did you get your first customer?
It's an interesting story. I mean, so remember, this is you know, middle of 2015. You know, Karthik, my co-founder, was at Flipkart. We you know, he had a 3-month notice period. He had, you know, and he'd just come off, like, you know, Big Billion Day, the first Big Billion Day, and you know, he had his daughter. You know, I always feel like, you know, I feel like I took a risk, and a lot of people say, you know, you took a risk, and I honestly, in my mind, you know, I mean, what did I really have to lose? You know, we started the company when his daughter was a year old, was a month old, right? And and I think you know, it's Mother's Day today, and I feel like, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't sort of think about, you know, all the things that, you know, many of the men in you know, in this world are able to do. I mean, a lot of them are only possible because there are incredible women allowing us this you know, opportunity, either as mothers or as co-workers or as you know, partners to really, you know, live our lives in meaningful ways and you know, live our dreams, and often at times with great sacrifice. So I mean, happy Mother's Day to everyone. But I think looking back, we were clear we wanted to work with Kiranas, right? We were also clear that we wanted to solve. I mean, if you really look at the life of a Kirana, right? There's two big problems, right? One is, okay, I have a limited number of consumers that can walk into my store, and so, okay, how do I maximize, you know, that? Because there's about a 300-400-500 meter radius, right, around food.
You're optimizing for the revenue per person that walks into your store.
Correct. Right. There's that. Right. So at some point you run out of new people that you can bring. Yeah, so nobody. I mean, I joke with. It sounds like a joke, but I can tell you. I mean, nobody understands, you know, the CAC to LTV, you know, logic better than a Kirana. I mean, they may not sort of talk about it in that way, but, you know, they will go to great lengths to retain customers. I mean, you know, it's amazing. You know, you walk into a Kirana store, you ask for something.
Never thought about that.
And, you know,
that's why the service and giving people credit.
Yeah. Because, you know, if you know that you're not going to have like an infinite number of consumers to get, you do whatever it takes to actually provide whatever level of service that you can provide. I mean, you know, there are people who, if you walk into a Kirana today and that person doesn't have that product, right, they know that the person 10 feet down the road, you know, has that. And this is very different from literally any other part of the world, at least, you know, most parts of the, you know, developed world, which is, mm-hmm. you know, once you go to a big box store, which is kind of your option in most parts of, you know, let's say the US, I mean, there's, you know, you've parked your car, you've gone there's an invested cost, you'll go around, you'll find a substitute, perhaps all of that, right? Yeah. But when you're, you know, walking into a Kirana, I mean, you know that, okay, he doesn't have the product. I'm just going to go to the guy, next guy, you know, 10 feet away. And,
yeah.
And so, you know, in stock, right, matters massively to Kiranas, right? They don't want consumers walking in and asking for something and having to, you know, send them away. They will, in fact, sometimes go and buy from the next store at MRP, make a loss on that sale, but, yeah, you know, they'll come and get it to you, just to keep you as a customer. And I think that was one, there was a few realizations along the way that, you know, we had. But the idea was, you know, we definitely felt that, you know, if you really wanted to solve for Kirana's problems. One was obviously a problem. How do you get more consumers? How do you get more demand? And then the other problem was, you know, Kiranas were spending and are still in many parts of the country spending 60-70% of the time just making sure that their, you know, stores remain in stock, right? And if you sort of connect those two problems, what levers does the Kirana, at least at a basic level, have to, you know, retain consumers or get new consumers? It is to, you know, carry a more relevant assortment or a selection of products that, you know, consumers want in your area. It has to be hyper-localized.
Yeah. Right?
They have to be in stock. Those are two actually big reasons. I mean, you don't necessarily go in, you know, for pricing reasons to a Kirana, right?
Yeah.
But the convenience is worth it. And so we said, okay, let's try and solve the problem of keeping products in stock, because, you know, once you earn the trust of the retailer, then, you know, you can actually help them also solve problems on the consumer side. And so the first part of the you know, this value chain that we started to solve for was, you know, how can we help kiranas source more effectively? And in that process, how can we help brands reach kiranas more effectively, or manufacturers more generally, right? Because if you really look at a retailer, about 65% of a retailer's products are actually not branded per se. I mean, they're, you know, staples, wheat, rice, pulses, spices, things like that, that are, you know, you have to go to a mandi to buy. Which is actually even more complicated to go, because you have to go like 30, 40 kilometers, shut your shop down, you know, buy a full, because you can't go there every day. You have to buy a lot of material, you know, expose yourself to all the dangers of transportation along the way, block a lot of working capital, end up, you know, holding a lot of days of inventory, and therefore your selection further shrinks. And so we said, let's solve that problem.
So you're in the process of someone going to a mandi, picking up stuff and coming back, which is something that someone would do like once a week, or how often?
It's tough to do once a week. It's tough to do once a week. You know, it's a once in 15 days or once in, you know, 30 days, because, you know, depends on how far you are, and, you know, how much
this is the current state that you guys are looking at. Okay.
Correct. And again, there again, right? I mean, having to go literally store by store, you know, there's a guy who sells rice, there's a guy who sells pulses, there's a guy who sells. So it's a lot of, you know, a typical kirana is dealing with 100 to 150 different suppliers. It's mind-boggling. I mean, I remember when we started out, you know, I went out to a whole bunch of our neighborhood kiranas and I got friendly with them. And I said, you know, sir, why don't you give me your bills, right? And I went in and manually digitized all these bills. And I said, okay, let me just even try and understand, you know, how many people are these people dealing with? And it was mind-boggling. I mean, it was like 150 different suppliers a month. Can you imagine? I mean, for a store that's selling, you know, four and a half, 5 lakh rupees, or, you know, $100,000 a year, right? I mean, you're talking about that person dealing with 150 suppliers. It's a very fragmented market. And that was also one of the things that attracted us to this, which was that, you know, we're a country where, unlike, you know, let's say the US, where, you know, farming is very, very, you know, concentrated, retail is fairly concentrated. In our country, I mean, there's, you know, 600 million farmers, you know, tens of thousands of, you know, different manufacturers, 14 million kiranas. There's not really much, you know, in terms of concentration, right? I mean, and so that's great for the internet. That's great for, you know, e-commerce, because you actually have a mechanism by which now, you know, fragmentation on both sides of the value chain is actually a great place to be building an e-commerce business. So we said, let's build a business which doesn't require a sales force in the first place. And this is, again, you know, one of those antithetical things to, you know, people said, oh, you're building, you know, B2B. And I always tell people, right, we're building B to small B. The small B is the small business, which is very consumerish in the ways that it operates. And therefore, you can't take your typical sort of B2B SaaS type of, you know, playbook to this.
When you think of it in terms of CAC and LTV as well, if you have a sales force, it becomes pretty hard to justify the acquisition costs. So, yeah.
I mean, you know, we do have a small team of people. I think at this point, right, we serve nearly 300,000 retailers across 50 cities, you know, across the country. We have 200 people that are onboarding people across these cities. But, you know, after that onboarding happens, everything goes, you know, digital, and everything is done through the app. So there's no sales force, no 100% of our orders actually come through the app. And this is something that's fairly unique. A lot of people, there's about 20, 30 companies across the world trying to do something similar. Nobody comes even close in terms of being able to get to 100% in terms of, you know, no salesperson walking into the store to make orders. It actually does, as you rightly said, right, change your CAC to LTV dramatically. I mean, our CAC is 100 rupees, I mean, like, you know, a dollar and a half. And, you know, lifetime retention over years and years, you get, you know, from first order is 60, 70% with no real, you know, sales force on the ground. But, you know, remember, this is 2015. This was 2G, 3G era, right? People had WhatsApp packs at that point.
How do you convince people to digitize their kirana store? That must have been...
People thought we were crazy. and I think that, you know, we people told us so much that we were crazy that, you know, we sometimes started to sort of doubt ourselves. But we said, okay, let's do like a, you know, simple experiment, right? This is a time when people used to switch off, you know, data packs at night so that, you know, they wouldn't have, you know, there was this fear that, you know, usage would go up. And so I remember, I think it's September of 2015, Karthik and I, you know, sitting at night around 10:30, we said, okay, let's, you know, by that time we'd had 5 or 6, you know, retailers that we were talking to quite a bit and trying to understand what was going on in the space. And so we said, okay, let's, you know, put all these guys in a WhatsApp group. Okay. And the reason to put it in a WhatsApp group was, you know, you could get these blue ticks, right? The two blue ticks. So you'd be able to see, right? Yeah. What time was it delivered and what time did they read it? And we said, okay, you know, hypothesis was they'll probably switch it off at night, and therefore, you know, let's see what time it got delivered and what time it actually got read. So I think at 10:40 or so, we sent out this message. I looked back at it and had all these emojis and all of these things, and it was like, you know, this is the rate of, you know, these following products, and, you know, tell us if you'd be interested in you know, finding out more. And we sent this to this group of five customers. And, you know, I might see
when they reply.
Sorry?
You send this out at night, you're saying, waiting to see.
Yeah, it's at 10:40 p.m., you know, some middle of the night in September 2015. Yeah. And we said, okay, you know, if we get like blue ticks, we know that there is a play here because people are at least reading their messages, right? Okay. And I get goosebumps when I think back about this, because at 10:43, we had four orders.
Oh. Oh my God.
Right, and I was like, wow, right? This is definitely not what we expected.
Yeah.
And so then next morning was like, okay, I got to go to the wholesale Monday to actually get what I told these guys I could give them. Yeah. So I went, you know, I took Karthik's car, and you know, in the boot of his Honda City at that time, we brought like these, you know, 10 boxes of oil back, and I, you know, took a bill, and I said, you know, thank you for your service, and you know, went and did these deliveries myself. And that's sort of where it got started. And, you know, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you can't really plan these things, but I think, you know, once you see, you know, this traction, you got to sort of follow it, right? I mean, I think everybody told us, you know, start with, you know, FMCG, brands are there, brands will
go to the big companies. Correct. On the ground, and I think this is a great lesson for our listeners. We've heard this so many times. You need to talk to your users, right? Who are going to actually, like, people who are actually going to use your product. It's not the FMCG companies, for sure.
Correct. Oh, and I think the other point that you made, Mazen, right? Talk and listen at the same time. Yeah. I think oftentimes, right? I think I made this mistake a lot of times. You know, you start with a preconceived notion of what the world should look like, and, you know, I mean, especially now, right? I mean, there's so much content out there about, you know, go talk to your customers, you know, speak to your customers, all of that. But I think I find a lot of people making this mistake, which is you go out with a preconceived notion. It's almost like, you know, let me check the box of, you know, have I spoken to 50 customers, right? But, you know, it is speaking with and listening rather than, you know, talking at. And I think that is something that... We made a lot of mistakes on that one, right? But I think over a period of time, just sheer volume of customers and, you know, hearing them, and also just spending time looking at how they were operating. I mean, I think a lot of users will, you know, tell you things that they sometimes feel like they want you to hear, right? You've come here, you've asked a question. Yeah. Nobody wants to feel like, you know, nobody wants to tell you, hey, I'm not really thinking about this. I'm sort of operating out of instinct, right? Everybody wants to be like, oh, I have this, you know, framework, and how this is how I decide, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so as much as talking and listening to customers, I think it's important to also just see what they're doing, right? Because many times what they do is completely opposite to what they say they do, right? I just give great example in this space, at least in our minds, is every single retailer in the country that I have ever spoken to, and I've spoken to now tens of thousands of them, right? Will tell you primary decision-making factor is price.
Okay, but it's not.
Right? That, you know, how do you decide? It's price. If sasta hai, toh main le lunga, right? That, and it seems obvious, and it confirms, you know, the, you know, what we imagine, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right? So it's like, oh, check the box. I've spoken to my retailer. Pricing is what it is. Let's go out and build, you know, the marketplace that, you know, provides pricing. And I think... at least in our realization, it's not not an insignificant lever, but it's definitely, in our opinion, not the only lever. And I think going back to the point I made about, you know, in stock, the fact that, you know, the retailer wants consumers to stick around and continue to spend more. I think we've realized that service is actually a convenience, reliability, trust. These are harder things to build for because they're harder things to convince people about. You have to experience that to actually do it, right? Especially when you're trying to do this without a sales force.
Right.
You know, you can go to tell someone, you know, pricing is easy, right? I mean, you see the price, you see a price here, you can make a decision.
Right. Exactly.
You know, pretty obvious, right? Challenge is, you know, keeping that up and you know, building that out as a moat is tough, in our opinion. I think sort of leads to this problem of, you know, sort of nobody wins in that battle because there's always somebody who can price, you know, lower than you just by burning a little bit more money than you can. And I don't think that's the foundation of building a, you know, a viable business. And so, I think we said, okay, we got to build based on service level, reliability, trust, convenience. And so, you know, a lot of the decisions that we took were this no Salesforce, 100% on app. There were times when people would call us and, you know, they'd say, you know, Mira, my internet pack is exhausted. You know, place an order, right? Take a phone.
Manually on the phone.
Right. And we'd say, no, you know, we'll I'll update, you know, give me your number. I'll actually buy you an internet pack, right? On the phone. You place the order. You can pay me when you get the delivery, but I'm not going to take an order on the phone. And you know, sometimes it's about being really, really, I think looking back, I mean, why is Jumbotail the only platform in the world that's been able to get retailers to come and, you know, place orders repeatedly? And our frequencies are like, you know, 4 or 5x of anybody else in this ecosystem, right? There are retailers who place orders 31 days in a month. And that has also come from, and people ask us, you know, what's the secret? And it's a little tough to actually tell people what the secret is, because there's no one secret, right? I think the biggest secret is we just didn't allow ourselves to build any other way of doing it. And so, you know, teams figured it out along the way, right? I think the biggest, you know, barrier oftentimes to building a business is your own belief that, you know, whether it can be done and or not done, right? And I think you have to almost sometimes believe it before it's possible. Because if I hadn't, you know, I think we hadn't believed that it was possible, you know, the easiest thing to have done, you know, to have scaled faster would have been to actually put a Salesforce on the ground, put a telecalling team. I mean, we're a 7.5-year-old company, right? I mean, we're the largest business in this ecosystem today if it comes to true e-commerce. But, you know, for the first 5.5 years, we were in one city.
Wow. 5.5 years in one city. So it was word of mouth growth and organic. Like, how were you guys thinking about getting the word out there without a Salesforce? And obviously, this is not the kind of sector where SEO works, right? You can't do Google ads. So, like, how do you actually get people to talk, you know, first in one city, and then when you branched out, how did you kind of replicate that?
Yeah. So I think the reason to be in one city was, you know, we realized very early on that this is probably the largest market in this country, if you think about it, right? I mean, $600-700 billion today, people talk of it being a $1 trillion market. TAM's not a problem, right? Yeah. And it's a very fragmented market. So it's not even a winner take all business, right? I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier, right? 150 different suppliers dealing with one retailer. So it'll come down over a period of time. I mean, and today, you know, there are retailers where we get 25-30% of their share of wallet, which makes us by far the largest partner. But it's a journey, right? And in that journey, we realized that, you know, you had to be capital efficient, right? I mean, we've built now today the largest business in this ecosystem with about 5% of the capital of anybody else, or at least some of our larger, you know, competition, right? And that came from a belief that, you know, it couldn't be discounting, it couldn't be pricing led, it had to be service and convenience and reliability, right? Which means you had to build a supply chain, all those capabilities. We run, you know, warehousing, we run last mile logistics. And in this country, I mean, you know, I think my realization has been that you have to do the hard work, right? I mean, if you really want to build moats, you have to do the hard work. A lot of gray hair on my head is a function of, you know, building today. What is the largest, most efficient supply chain for food and grocery in the country, right? We literally run a B2C like supply chain serving retailers. What I mean by that is you can literally order one unit. There's no minimum order quantity. But what we make up, what we lose in terms of, you know, that scale at a single, you know, product level is something that we more than make up in density and frequency, and therefore the efficiency is actually higher. But I think the first 5.5 years was really about building that out. And then, you know, once we felt that we had something that could scale, you know, rapidly and effectively, I mean, there's still a need of people to actually go and talk to the store the first time and download the app.
It's an onboarding process, right?
Where you correct. Correct. Yeah. But that's a 10-minute conversation. It costs you, you know, 70, 80 rupees if you take the cost of the person going and doing that. But after that, you know, the what we figured out over that 5.5-year journey was provide a great first experience that causes the retailer to order for the second time, the third time, and the fourth time. And what we realized is once you get 5 orders, you know, they almost never drop off unless the store shuts down.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, you know, you every delivery is goes into your trust piggy bank. Every bad experience obviously takes a lot more out of that trust piggy bank. And so you have to have enough, you know, before you screw up. But we do nearly, you know, at this point, I mean, you know, very soon later this year, we'll do 1 million deliveries a month, right? And so even at small, you know, error rates, you will impact customers. But I think what we've realized is that the beauty of a high frequency business, and ours is definitely a high frequency business, You know, nearly anywhere between 65 and 80% of our sales actually come from retailers who order between 9 and 30 times a month. So, you know, the beauty of a high frequency business is that when you do the right thing, your trust actually goes up exponentially. Obviously, the nature of a high quality.
Right? And I think
exactly.
It's fascinating.
But the danger of a high frequency. Exactly. The danger of a high frequency business, if you give people bad experiences, it also goes down exponentially quickly, and you know you're dead. But that's the you know way we chose to build it, and therefore you know in a year and a half, from year 5.5 to 7, we were able to you know scale from 1 city to 50 cities, and you know and you see the same metrics in fact playing out a lot better across cities. You know, smaller you know Bangalore obviously is our largest city, but today, Bangalore is only about 30% of the you know overall business. It's profitable today, and other cities are fast catching up. And I see much better metrics in those cities because you know choices that retailers have are even lower. So that sort of
build it out right, get everything to work, and then 1.5 years scale it.
Correct. And that's the same approach that we're actually taking with our you know second business, which is if you actually look at the B2B side of the business, right? I mean, what we do is we have the e-commerce marketplace. We have about, you know, 35,000 SKUs on one side across about 2,000, you know, brands or manufacturers, 300,000 retailers approximately on that. And then we do, you know, supply chain logistics, solve for payment and credit. It's you know, we're one of the early, I guess, people to sort of get into solving for, you know, fintech and payments for this ecosystem. You know, nearly, I mean, last year was, you know, 1,000+ crores of credit enabled 99.8% repayment. So that's one part of our business, and you know credit is obviously a meaningful portion of fintech is a meaningful portion of the transactions that are happening. But you know there's obviously a lot of transactions that happen without credit as well. And if you actually look at the you know at some point we realize okay now it's time to actually solve the second problem or actually if you look at the in the minds of the retailer number one problem, which is how do I, as a retailer, you know, get more consumers? How do I get more consumers to come to me more often, spend more of their share of wallet with me? Okay. And that's where you know we're now building a business that we call J24. It's predicated. Think about it as a modern convenience grocery store in a box, right? I mean, if you're an entrepreneur, whether you have experience with running a convenience retail store before or not. You can, you know, come to Jumbotail and say, I want to do this. And we'll give you, you know, pretty much all the resources that you need to be able to, you know, set up a modern convenience grocery store.
So that's all the tech resources, like the website and all of that, and or physical
so resources. If you, absolutely, completely, everything, right? So if you look at what it takes to start a store, right? First is pick the right location. I mean, this is one, you know, thing in retail, everybody says, you know, location. Yes. And location is very critical, right? If you're not in a place where there is traffic, and we've built a lot of, you know, interesting technology around, you know, even, you know, using image processing to figure out, you know, how much traffic is there, what happens, you know, is this a place where you'll put a camera and understand, you know, what's happening? Is this a good place for you to actually first set up a store? We also obviously the B2B business gives us a very good understanding of you know where what's being ordered in which store, which area orders what type of product, etc. So we have a more holistic view of what products and demand work. But you know, starting from where to set up the store, what products to keep, you know, it's a 400-500 square foot store, but you know, we're able to because we service literally every day through our supply chain. You're able to actually reduce the number of inventory days that you have to hold and increase the in stock, and therefore these stores can carry anywhere between 1,200 to 1,500 SKUs or products, which are hyper targeted, right, to that 1 square kilometer area around you. And so you get when you walk in, you're like, oh wow, these guys know exactly what I need to have. And, you know, if they don't, for that matter, you can tell them. And then because, you know, Jumbotail, the marketplace has, you know, let's say in a city like Bangalore, maybe 12 to 15,000 SKUs, there's a good chance that, you know, they'll be able to order it and get it next time. So, you know, you walk in and you want something that you really, really, you know, like, and it's not available in the store. You can say, hey, sir, come back tomorrow. I'll get it for you.
I'll make sure they're there.
And they can, right? And then loyalty solutions, you know, you get loyalty points for walking in and transacting. There's an app that allows you to discover. There's an app that allows you to do pay later. If you really think about, you know, I believe that this is what the future of, you know, convenience retail in large parts of the world, at least parts of the world that, you know, have a Kirana-like ecosystem will look like, right? And India is going to be at the vanguard of making that happen. I think, you know, you're based in a city where, you know, 7-Eleven and Family Mart and all these places have great, you know, very interesting things there. And I think India will be one of the places over the next 10 years which will really lead the charge in transforming how retail operates. And I think in that,
I think it's fascinating. Like, we've seen a couple of companies in Indonesia come up that are copying Indian models and
correct. India is going to be the fountain of, I think, a lot of innovation that will then get, you know, that will serve to inspire people across the world. I think Southeast Asia, large parts of Africa, large parts of Latin America, a lot of context is similar.
Yeah.
And I think our belief is that over the next 5-10 years, you know, a model where the entrepreneur continues to run the store, but is really, you know, empowered by, you know, a series of solutions, right? Which they could be on, you know, planogramming, how to run promotions, how to bring consumers in, how to create, you know, digital relationships with consumers, how to create sort of omni-channel relationships with consumers. And, you know, so the power of, we call them giants, right? The entrepreneurs that are part of the J24 network are called giants. Giants empowered by the solutions that, you know, we provide. Some version of that is, I think, what a large number of, you know, consumer convenience grocery stores, neighborhood grocery stores are going to actually have. And they take the best of both worlds, right? Which is the deep personal relationships, the sense of, you know, community that they bring, the incredible hard work that they do, the incredible cost structures at which they're able to operate. And then on top of that, really being able to sort of, you know, build meaningful relationships with their consumers, not having to worry about how to get stock, new solutions in terms of, you know, what products to carry, you know, access to fruits and vegetables as a set of products, which most retailers otherwise don't carry because it's really complicated. That, I believe, is what the future of, you know, a lot of, you know, retail, at least in urban India, is going to look like, and perhaps large parts of the world as well. And that's, therefore, we're very excited about that part of the business now. And that would only have been possible, I think, because it rides on top of this, you know, much larger, obviously, B2B business, which is highly efficient and scalable.
No, it's amazing. And talking about the future, I mean, it's now quite an exciting space. It wasn't when you joined in 2015. And one of the initiatives I wanted to ask you about was ONDC. I mean, you've worked with Nandan Nilekani himself. And so have you guys participated in ONDC? Do you think that that'll play a huge role in the future? And how do you see it shaping up?
I think as a country, we're really, you know, India is really leading the world in terms of, you know, large digital public infrastructure. And I think that's a great thing. I mean, I think it will create immense prosperity, you know, the entire India stack, right? I think with ONDC, you know, I think anything that is a driver of digital adoption, be it through consumers, be it through retailers, be it for brands, is generally a good thing for this country, right? I think that it will move us forward much faster than you know, any other way that people would have chosen. And the fact that the government is, you know, putting its full weight behind it is an incredible thing. I think there's, you know, significant differences between how, let's say, ONDC would have to solve for, you know, problems versus, say, how UPI did it in the past. It is a, you know, commerce, especially in our category, is a little, you know, is a multi-dimensional problem. I think solving for some of those things will take time. But when it does, I think, you know, it'll be pretty transformational. I think, you know, when I look at digital adoption, I think a lot of us immediately jump to, you know, people will place orders online and delivery will happen, right? I think that's a very narrow view of how, you know, digital can really change the face of commerce in food and grocery. I think there's, you know, fundamental things to be solved in India, right? I mean, and this applies as much to quick commerce or, you know, B2C internet e-commerce as well. Between, you know, maximum retail price, which is a construct in India, which doesn't allow you to price above a certain level. Between the fact that the more convenient you make something, that the more you push people towards smaller and smaller ticket sizes. Between the fact that it is going to become, in all likelihood, more and more expensive to deliver, because if you, until such time that drone delivery or teleportation comes in, it's likely that, you know, salaries in India and you know, working class salaries will go up, right?
Yeah.
And so a model which is entirely predicated on just delivery of small ticket, relatively low value items. I mean, just to give you a sense, right? I mean, an iPhone has the same form factor as a masala packet or a, you know, packet of biscuits. A packet of biscuits that has the same form factor as an iPhone, which costs, you know, 1 lakh rupees, is 5 rupees, right? And but the cost of delivery is exactly the same. And so, you know, there will be high density pockets where that will happen. There will be certain ticket sizes at which it will happen. There will be places where people will be willing to pay delivery fees where that will happen. But I think we would do ourselves a big disservice as a country if we only think about, you know, digital and the internet and, you know, as being, you know, only applicable where home delivery happens or, you know, digital commerce happens. I mean, you know, let me give you an example, right? I mean, even today, there are many kiranas where 20-30% of their sales actually come from somebody, you know, calling them and saying, you know, bhaiya, I'm calling from the house nearby, you know, send this to me, right? And we don't call it e-commerce, right? But if you now put a Alexa or a Google, system that sort of you talk into it and that gets transition or that message goes to the kirana and they deliver, suddenly, you know, it becomes e-commerce. But effectively, I mean, nothing really changed, right? And so there will be, but I think the future and ONDC is a very large, you know, and you know, it's great because it sort of is this rallying cry. And I've seen this journey with Aadhaar before, and I've seen this journey with now UPI as well.
Yeah.
It will push people to actively consider this much faster than they would have otherwise done it. And so,
right,
you know, a truly omni-channel, digitally enabled future, which is an inevitability in my mind, will only happen faster because more people and more smart people and more capital will, you know, find its way towards doing this. And I'm not to say that capital is the only way to solve it, but I think, you know, just the attention of very smart people with this view that when you realize, you know, something's inevitable, oftentimes a lot of blinders come off, and I think it frees people up to think with a little bit more imagination and creativity to solve problems. And I think that's it's never been a better time to be building a business like ours or, you know, many other businesses in this country. And I'm very fortunate to be living in this time and having you know, the opportunity to participate in that journey.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. So before we wrap up, I want to ask you one question that, you know, yes, we ask all our guests. It's why we call this show Founders Unfiltered. What is some unfiltered feedback that you've received from someone that's really impacted you personally or professionally?
Give me a minute to think about it.
Yes, of course.
And you want to also ask me, now that we're recording this, you want to ask me what the other one is?
We'll add that in, yes.
Yeah.
So we'll do the unfiltered one and then we'll come back.
Yeah, that's a tough one, man. Give me 10 seconds to think about it.
Yeah, take your time. No worries.
I think this was in terms of an unfiltered advice. I mean, I think this was about a year in, you know, to my entrepreneurial journey, and you know, when you're building a business that has a lot of moving parts, right? I mean, there's supply chain, there's you know, e-commerce, there's credit, there's a lot of things that break, right? And I think that if I look back at my career up until then, you know, consulting sort of is this, you've got to get everything right. And, you know, it has to be perfect. And it has to be, you know, all the I's must be dotted and the T's must be crossed. And I think, you know, a friend of mine who again, you know, runs a very large e-commerce business, at one point, you know, he told me, you know, we were just talking, and I was sort of ranting about, you know, this is not working. Why is this, you know, why is it so difficult to do? And he said, you know, things are going to break. And, you know, if the easiest way to kill your business, which you are in the process of doing, if you continue to do this, is to try and go around with a, you know, fire extinguisher, trying to put down every fire that is there. Right. And he said, you know, don't do that. I mean, you're going to kill your business, and you're going to stifle any creativity or any, you know, risk-taking ability that your teams have if everything has to be perfect the first time. And you will miss the forest for the trees. You will miss the biggest fire. you will get this dopamine hit of, you know, having solved a little bit of a problem every time, you know, every time. But there'll be a fire burning that you will miss because of that, and it will kill your business, and you're doing that right now. And again, like, looking back, I mean, it's pretty obvious, right? And it's very tough. I still don't, I mean, I will not, I'll not claim that I can always do it. I mean, I am very, very obsessive about the small details, and it's important. I mean, looking back, I think you can't not be.
Yeah.
But I think learning how to let some fires burn, but making sure that they are the right fires burning and not the wrong fires burning is
and that's the key, right? Which fires do you let burn?
Exactly. And you know, sometimes you get it wrong and you get singed, and you know, you got to be constantly watching out for that. But I think that was really, like, I mean, the imagery of that was very powerful. Am I able to, you know, implement it? Sadly, no, all the time. I don't think I'm able to do it. And, you know, there is a certain obsessiveness that one also must have. And so it's a balancing act. But I think if he hadn't told me that, I would have either, you know, burnt out a long time ago or you know, just been, you know, more insufferable than I probably already am. Neither of which would have been great for the business. And so I really, really appreciate that advice.
And Ashish, what's one truth that very few people would agree with you on?
So I think that, you know, especially one when one has a little bit of, you know, quote unquote success in life, right? You have a few fancy names on your resume, your company's raised a little bit of money, you have customers that like, you know, like you, you get to come on podcasts like this. You know, there's a tendency that, you know, we try and sort of attribute a lot more of our success to a plan and, you know, as you know, a very focused execution as per a plan. And I'm a big believer that, you know, honestly, serendipity and luck are such an important part of all of this that, you know, sometimes we take ourselves a little bit too seriously and, you know, you buy into this self-image of, you know, I made it happen. And I think a lot of time, and that's the day when, you know, you're really screwed because, I think a large part of literally every major, you know, turn in my life. I mean, you know, how I met Karthik at this wedding, you know, this chance meeting, you know, that led me to, you know, do this project with the public distribution system for 3 years, mm-hmm. right? Literally every decision in my life that has been consequential looking back and probably has led me to this path or to this point has been a serendipitous one, right? And so I think being open to that, not sort of being so sure of yourself that, you get in your own way. I think, you know, putting yourself in a variety of different situations and really not really, you know, having a point of view on why is this going to be meaningful or helpful in the short term, right? I think it makes life more interesting. It allows you to, I have this motto in life I mentioned to earlier as well, right? Which is, you know, is this going to be an interesting story someday? And, you know, if it has a chance of being an interesting story, whether or not it makes sense in the current scheme of things, you know, life is much more fun when that happens. And, you know, great coincidences have often led to incredible things. And it also allows you to actually sort of look at various different domains. And I think if you look at some of the biggest, you know, innovations in life or society, they've all come from, you know, people who took a very different view of, you know, an established business. Mm-hmm. And so if you, you know, want to sort of try and emulate that path, following more of a Brownian motion path is probably, in my mind, at least, that's made life a lot more fun and interesting. And, you know, it's worked out reasonably okay so far. So, you know, I'm going to continue to do that.
No, that's amazing. I think, you know, it's putting yourself in the right place to get lucky.
And not necessarily, you know, not necessarily doing it in a very purposeful manner, right? I think a lot of times, right, you know, right now with, you know, all this content out there, people talk about, oh, you know, you got to go to these meetings, you got to go and network. And no, man, I mean, no, you know, because that's not the beaten path. That's not serendipitous then, right? Because everybody's doing it. And so, you know, do shit that nobody else is doing, right? And don't worry about, you know, what other people are going to say, and don't worry about, you know, is this going to let me get a new, you know, better job, or is this going to get me, you know, a network? I mean, if everybody is thinking that way, then, you know, the chances of you getting a disproportionate return or a different outcome is probably lower if you do the same thing as everybody else does.
You're going to be like everybody else, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ashish. It has been really, it's really been a pleasure hearing about your journey. I've learned so much. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Mazin and Avril, for the opportunity to share my story. And, you know, hopefully, you know, it's I really enjoyed this. And so I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity.